This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last May, the Fox Network demonstrated the faith it had in one of its new fall prospects, a musical comedy series called Glee, by offering a sneak preview of it right after the final night of competition on American Idol. This week, Glee was launched officially as a fall series, so we're listening back to Terry's interview with the show's creator, Ryan Murphy. Ryan Murphy also created the WB teen comedy titled Popular and the darkly comic FX series Nip Tuck about two egocentric cosmetic surgeons. Murphy also directed the movie Running with Scissors. The series Glee is about a high school teacher who is trying to put together a winning high school Glee club with a group of students who are, for the most part, unpopular misfits and not particularly talented, with one or two key exceptions. The high school teacher, played by Matthew Morrison, also has to contend with challenges from the coach of the cheerleading squad, who sees the Glee Club as competition. In this scene, the cheerleading coach confronts him. She's played by Jane Lynch.
So I had a little chat with Principal Figgins, and he said that if your group doesn't place at regionals, he's cutting the program. Ouch.
You know, you don't have to worry about Glee Club. We're going to be fine.
Really? Because I was at the local library where I read Cheerleading Today Allowed to Blind Geriatrics. I came across this little page turner, show choir rule book. And turns out you need 12 kids to qualify for regionals. Last time I looked at you, only had 5.5. Here, cripple in the wheelchair. I also took the liberty of highlighting some special ed classes for you. Maybe you could find some recruits. Because I'm not sure there's anybody else who's going to want to swim over to your island of misfit toys.
Are you threatening me, Sue?
Threatening you? Oh, no, no, no. Presenting you with an opportunity to compromise yourself? You betcha.
Ryan Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the premise of the show is that there's a teacher trying to put together a really good show choir who can make it to the nationals and even win. Though he's working with this kind of like ragtag group. I'm not familiar with a show choir, and I assume that these exist, that you didn't just make it up for the series. But the show choir, it's like a choir, and it's a singing competition, but what they compete with is big like song and dance production numbers. It's not just, people in robes standing there singing.
No, I mean, it was an interesting thing that I had. When I was a kid, I was in choir, but it was, literally 16 of us in sad-looking tuxedos and acetate dresses,
right.
singing, Christmas songs. But the world has changed since then. And when we started writing this, we would go onto YouTube and we would look at these videos of these extravaganzas, and they are literally like Broadway-level shows. I mean, we were working with a choir during the pilot from Burbank who I think literally would spend $100,000 a year on costumes and sets and production value. So they had, I think, one woman who was a full-time sequin sewer. So we sort of tap into that a little bit. But on our show, our show was about underdogs, but we have the world's worst Glee Club. And I think the fun of the show to me is being able to sort of chart these kids who have nothing going for them but heart and, natural talent. And then over the course of the series, they will hopefully become national champions.
So while you were going onto YouTube to look at all these show choir production numbers, what were some of the most unlikely songs that you saw show choirs do?
I think it was very interesting about how moving it was to me. I was not expected to be so moved by it, but I think there's nothing more moving than kids singing and performing their hearts out, just because it seems like they're tapping into something so pure.
That's what I'll even go to like high school production number, high school musical sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sweet. And, I remember being that age, and when you do perform and you are in high school, I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, but I thought that I was on Broadway. You have this sort of weird misconception that the whole world is open to you, and maybe that's not a misconception, maybe it's the truth, but I pulled from that. That feeling is in the show. But to answer your question, the funniest thing I saw was a boy band tribute where they did like a medley of 15 boy band songs that I thought was pretty amazing. But they did it through the prism of Western wear, So they all wore cowboy outfits, and it was sort of this weird smash-up of elements that you kind of can't believe would work, but it did. And it worked because it was just so earnest. They believed in it so much, and that's what I loved about it.
So how did you go about, like, shopping for songs that you should use, and what were some of the more unlikely ones you decided on? I'll name one. I kissed a girl for the audition.
Right. The best part of my job is I pick all the songs, and people ask me how I do it, and it's just bizarre. I don't really know. Like, for instance, when we were doing the pilot, there was the sort of arch nemesis group, the world's best show choir that's competing against our little ragtag group of losers called Vocal Adrenaline, and they're sort of like, you know, the neo-Nazis of show choir that they train for 12 hours a day. And there really are groups like this, so it's not too much of a leap of faith. But I wanted them to do something that was sort of big and ironic. And then I was in my car and I was listening to the Amy Winehouse album Back to Black, and Rehab came on. And I thought, well, that's it, because I think it'd be funny for 16-year-olds to be singing about rehab and not really knowing what they're singing about, put through a prism of show choir. So that's how we did that. There are other songs that, you know, I just loved as a kid. Like, you know, we're working on a show where we do a big finale to the Queen song Somebody to Love. We're doing our version of Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. Also, the show was fun in that, you know, we try and pick songs where there's something for everybody. We have in almost every episode, we'll have a standard, we'll have a Broadway, we'll have a R&B, we'll have a top 40, we'll have a hip-hop, we're doing country and western, so we're trying to hit everything.
Now, one of the kids in the choir is, like, the real nerdy guy who plays a real, like, shredding guitar, but he's mm-hmm. he's in a wheelchair. So
yes.
How do you cast, like, the nerdy guy in the wheelchair? What were you looking for that character? And
I was just, for every character, you know, I mean, I think when you do a show like this, you need to do archetypes, but you also need to do things that are just original. And I wanted to do a character that from day one is in a wheelchair and remains in a wheelchair for the rest of the show. And the show is really about, you know, the show choir thing, I think, is a metaphor for being different and embracing your difference and being able to express yourself no matter how hard or how much pain you're in. So, for instance, for that character, we just read and read and read, and the actor we cast, his name is Kevin McHale. He actually was in a boy band and is in a boy band. And I think the name of their boy band is not, I think it's called Not Like Us. But he's hilarious, and we actually had to give him what we call a make-under because, you know, in his boy band stuff, he's in his tight little T-shirts and come-hither looks, and we sort of put him in these polyester horror show outfits. But that's how we cast that part. We just read and read. And, you know, the rule was the best performer wins for every role, and that's how we cast it.
Now, in the TV series Glee, there's a jock who, it turns out, sings really well, and he's kind of enlisted into the Glee Club. And he's accused by one of his fellow jocks of joining the homo explosion. Were you uh-huh. accused of being gay when you were in choir? And you are gay, so...
yeah.
What?
I had a very strange experience with that. I mean, I'm from Indiana, and which is a very conservative state. And I don't know what happened to me or by what grace of God I sort of was imbued with all this confidence. But I dealt with my sexuality at a very early age. I was 15, and I just sort of announced it, and I was that. And I guess because I was popular and I hung out with popular kids, you know, one of my best friends, and who is still one of my best friends, was the quarterback. I kind of was embraced. People didn't really understand me, but I projected a certain confidence, so they left me alone. I mean, certainly I got teased a little bit, but I had a very sort of wicked tongue, and I could go right back at them. So it didn't last very long. But looking back on it, I'm sort of moved by the fact that I didn't have a struggle. And I know so many people who did have a struggle and were terrified of dealing with it. And I dealt with it with my parents very early on, and they, of course, were not happy about it, and they, of course, took me to therapy. But I had a great therapist who, after two sessions, basically called my parents in and said, this is who your son is, and this is who he's always going to be, and you either have a choice to love him or accept him, or he will leave you, and it's your choice. And they sort of said, okay, and they chose accepting me, and so we never really had much drama about it again.
No, you were so lucky, especially since they were the parents who wanted you to change were the ones who put you into therapy. And to find a therapist who got it is kind of so lucky and amazing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't blame my parents about that at all. I mean, also, I was 15 and having an affair with a 22-year-old, which was not good.
Right.
When I have a child, and I would not allow that to happen either. So I sort of look back. Yeah, but I certainly I write about all that. And, you know, as we move to series, we have, a very moving storyline about a father who's coming to terms with the fact that his child is singing and is different, and he's a blue-collar guy. And a friend of mine who's a great actor named Mike O'Malley plays the father of the gay character who works at a tire shop and just cannot believe the fact that his son is dealing with skin care and astringents and singing. And that is, to a certain degree, based on my life. A little bit, but you know, the show is, that's a 1/10 of the show. The show, I think, is so much more consuming about every aspect of being young, not just that.
Now, in Glee, all the kids in it are in some ways losers. Like, everyone in
losers.
It is in some way a loser. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like when you were in high school, you were pretty popular and confident. So why do you relate to losers so much?
Well, because I was different, you know. And my friends were different. I had two groups of people. I had a group called The Clique. There were 8 of us. And then I had my other group of friends. And the group that we called The Clique were all the people who were like in drama club or honor society. And we were just different and unusual. And our dreams were bigger than where we were. And we wanted to get out. And that feeling I really understand. And that's the sort of the feeling that's in all those characters. That, you know, that their dreams are so big that their little heads almost can't contain them. That's what's moving to me, and I certainly draw on my experience when we're writing the show in that way.
Ryan Murphy, creator of the new Fox series Glee. He also created the WB teen comedy Popular and Nip Tuck, the FX series about cosmetic surgery. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Ryan Murphy, creator of the new Fox musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club. The series premiered this week.
Now, you covered Hollywood for the Miami Herald?
A lot of places. Washington Post, Miami Herald, Daily News.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you covered Hollywood before actually becoming a part of it in the sense of like creating television shows. When you were just like covering it and you were writing about, you know, new shows and you know, the lives of famous actors and stuff, did you think, I really want to be a part of that? Or did you think, oh, I could do that or I could do better than that? Like, what was your relationship to Hollywood as a journalist? And did you want to get deeper into it?
I did. I mean, I always wanted to do that. I couldn't really afford to go to film school, even though I was accepted. But I always, in the back of my mind, thought, well, I'll get out there somehow. I don't know how. And how it happened was I was transferred to L.A., at a very young age. I was sort of like the L.A. bureau chief of the Miami Herald back when newspapers had money and could afford to do things like that. And I was going to start writing about news, but there's not a lot of news in L.A., so it became about celebrities and the business of Hollywood and all that stuff. And I had a syndicated column. And it never was that I wanted to be a part of it. I just at one point, I think what happened was I had interviewed Cher for the 5th time, and I was like, okay, you got to do something else. Even though I love her, I can't keep writing about her. We had a joke about it. And I went and I wrote a script, and at night when I was done working, I would stay up every night till like 3 in the morning writing, and I sold that script to Steven Spielberg, and that started my career. It just sort of happened. It was very sort of miraculous, and easy is the wrong word, because I guess that I had been preparing for that moment all along, but I literally just sort of wrote it, sold it, and fell into it and have never stopped working since. It was a great script that's never been made, but it's called Why Can't I Be Audrey Hepburn? that it was a big romantic comedy, and Spielberg particularly took a shine to it because he directed Audrey Hepburn in her last movie, which was Always. So he had a great relationship with her, and it was just about what she means as a metaphor in terms of romantic comedy to so many people. And it's sort of this paragon of style that so many girls of a particular age always aim to emulate.
So your parents were religious, they were church people. Did that make it harder for them when you came out?
Probably. Yeah. I think, you know, we were Catholic, and that was, the things you don't want to do when you're in a Catholic person is talk about abortion or gay rights. So, yeah, I think it probably was more difficult for them. And I went to Catholic school as well.
Oh, so how did you deal with Catholic school and with going to church? I mean, you had been in the church choir. Once you were out, like, could you stay in Catholic school?
I only went to Catholic school when I was in, first through eighth grade. But I was just a weird kid. I mean, I lived in a weird fantasy land. And I was obsessed with, movies and TV shows and books and anything to sort of get me out of there. And I got through Catholic school because I became obsessed with the idea that I could be the Pope. I was very...
You gotta be kidding.
I wanted to be the Pope. It was like, well... So in first grade, I announced to my family that I really wanted to be the Pope. And I was very confused about how do you be the Pope. And so my mother would tell me that you became the Pope by not committing any sins. So I would sort of begin my day every morning with a prayer, please don't let me sin. And of course, by the time I got off the bus, I would have committed three. And then I was like, well, this day's ruined. I'll start again tomorrow. But I would practice with my staff, and I had this outfit of robes. I would pretend to... I mean, I was really into it for very, very many years. And then slowly it dawned on me that I would not be able to go through a day committing no sin. And chances were that I wasn't going to be the Pope. So I had to come up with another dream because I wasn't interested in just being a priest. I wanted to aim really, really high.
What?
But that was my childhood.
Outside of being like the top guy, why did you want to be Pope?
I was also obsessed with a book about the saints, and I thought it would be really cool to be the Pope because then you could decide who would get to be saints. And I was very interested in that process of sort of sitting people down or investigating them and figuring out what they had done made them worthy of that. I don't know. I was just very drawn to it. I think it's the same. There's no difference to me in my head about the little... 6-year-old kid who was obsessed with the funny girl and who wanted to be the Pope. It's the same thing. You just wanted a way out. You wanted a way to express yourself and to sort of not stay in Indiana and be an insurance salesman or a farmer. And they both were so grand and bigger than life. I was just drawn to that. And I was actually encouraged by my friends and family to keep doing it. So I did. I was just a weird little kid. I liked weird little things.
So since you had at one point wanted to be Pope when you came out and you were kind of persona
non grata. Doesn't that sound ridiculous?
Well,
so you wanted to be the Pope, but I did.
Yeah,
it's
whatever,
sad.
You know. But so when you came out and making you kind of officially persona non grata in the Catholic Church, did it hurt to be rejected by the Church, or were you already done with the Church by then?
I was already kind of done with the Church at an early age, but I'm very, very glad that I had that religious upbringing because, it really taught me about storytelling and it really taught me about theatricality. I mean, the Easter services and the idea of people being raised from the dead and curing leprosy and the, Stations of the Cross and all that stuff I was very drawn to, and I realize now that I was probably drawn to it because it was just about a way to tell a story. And so I feel like I was very well served by that. And I still go to church, even though the church is not very embracing. As a whole, I think if you look at individual archdioceses, you see that, many of the priests and the nuns and the people who work at the church are. So I do go to church. I go to church, here in Los Angeles, and I've always been embraced in the church. The different kind of churches that I go to seem to have a sort of large gay contingency and no one says anything. So I just think that it's a different world than it was. I don't think anything is black or white anymore.
Now, as the creator of Glee, which is a musical and a music competition about music competitions, I have to ask you, if you could get up on stage now and sing any one song, what would you choose?
That's a good one. It would probably have to be Don't Rain on My Parade, because I remember that was the first movie I ever saw, and Funny Girl, and I practiced that one a lot with a kitchen spoon in front of the mirror. So I would probably give that one a try.
Well, I wish I could see it. Ryan Murphy, thanks so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Ryan Murphy speaking with Terry Gross in May when Glee was given an advanced sneak preview. The show premiered officially this week. Here's the version of Rehab that was performed in the pilot of Glee by a champion show choir. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.